Hello and welcome to the latest edition of ICTJ Forum in our podcast series where we look at the news developments from a transitional justice perspective. Today with us we have Eduardo Gonzalez, the director of our Truth and Memory program. Welcome, Eduardo.
Thank you for having me, Rafik.
And Ruben Carranza, the director of our reparations program. Hello, Ruben.
Thank you again, Rafik.
Today, of course, the obvious topic would appear to be Egypt with everything that is happening there, but we will leave Egypt for this episode and turn to it maybe in the next. At this point in time, the only thing that I would say is that on behalf of ICTJ and personally, the priority number one is for the killing to stop and then for the Egyptians to look into the ways to address what is happening on the ground. We will, however, today talk about other contexts, other countries, Peru being the first and Philippines being the second, and then we will also have a discussion around the new documentary called The Act of Killing by Joshua Oppenheimer, which looks into the legacy of crimes committed in Indonesia. We will kick off the conversation with Peru. In Peru, on 28th of August, we will mark 10 years of the report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission there. In Peru, we have seen in the last several weeks a rise of discontent which was catalyzed by the tapes of deals being made around appointments of judges and the human rights ombudsman, but also a very interesting situation whereby, as the legacy of the times passed, these things, public demonstration against the state and police response to it have not been seen since 2000 and the demonstrations against the former president Fujimori. Eduardo, could you fill us in on what is happening right now in Peru and how does that reflect any of the issues of the past still being present and affecting the society?
Well, Peru has experienced an enormous economic growth, a boom basically led by the extractive industries, mainly mining, in the last decade or so, and there has been a significant growth of the economy, but the benefits of that growth have been felt and experienced basically in the larger cities and in the capital of Lima. So there is discontent among the working classes, among sectors who are out of Lima, indigenous communities and other communities whose territories and whose lands are being exploited for mining, but feel that they are not seeing the benefits of this exploitation. And so there has been a number of demonstrations and demands unsatisfied in the last few years. A couple of years ago, there was a very atrocious clash between indigenous peoples and police forces in the jungle of Peru that ended up with scores of people killed. Last year, there were confrontations in the northern and in the southern areas of the highlands, also with the result of people killed in clashes with the police. And this year, the demonstrations were sparked by evidence of accommodation between the larger political parties to take care of the instruments of control in democracy, instruments of constitutional control. What is happening is that clearly it is not enough for Peruvians to just have an economy that is buoyant. They also want the rule of law and they want a sense of justice. And it is not casual that the areas and the communities that see themselves as not included in the economic growth are the same areas and the same kinds of communities that were affected and victimized during the armed conflict. It is a sensation that they are always on the losing end. that they are always the ones that contribute to the growth of the nation, but they don't see the benefits, and in fact they feel the repression. So that is, regrettably, in a set of large brushes, what is happening in Peru. Now, at the same time, you have to recognize that what is happening also shows that the people of Peru are not prepared to just let this happen like that, and that there is a strong sense of stung pride and enraged citizenry that wants to claim and wants to affirm their rights. And this is also connected with the exercise that the Truth Commission opened 10 years ago, the affirmation that Peruvians have rights independently of where they are rich or poor, independently of where they live in the cities or in the countryside, of whether they are indigenous or non-indigenous. So I think that what we are seeing is probably something to which Peruvians are kind of accustomed, which is the fact that injustice and structural exclusion exist, but at the same time that there are networks of solidarity and struggle, and they will continue acting and reclaiming for their citizenship.
Let's focus a little on the anniversary of the final report of the CVR on 28th of August. There will be a conference in Lima looking into the legacy of the Truth Commission. What, in your opinion, in a nutshell, of course, it would require an episode dedicated to specifically this issue to give it any justice, but in a nutshell, what do you think is the positive legacy of the CVR, and also what is there that you would say were the shortcomings or in the implementation or in the outcomes of it?
Well, what I think the Commission did, and this was something unprecedented in the history of the country, is to give visibility to a population that was considered inexistent. Victims of human rights violations committed in the conflict, particularly victims of the action of the state, have been denied dignity, have been invisibilized, and or the violations they suffered have been justified by the dominant media and the dominant public opinion. I think that the Commission demonstrated that large swaths of the population in Peru suffered, that both the armed groups such as the Shining Path and the armed forces committed atrocities, and that all victims have dignity and have rights. So what the Commission did, I think, was to include in the national agenda an issue that was uncomfortable for the political elites, because some of them did have responsibilities for what happened. But it basically thematized an issue. It asked the country to realize that it had a problem that it had to deal with. And so I think that the best achievement of the Commission is to have inserted something into the national agenda. As difficult as it is to deal with it, it provided a platform for social movements claiming for the rule of law. At the same time, of course, the Commission was a limited exercise. It worked for a little less than 2 years to cover a very complex process of about 20 years of conflict. Even though the report is very complete, it's actually very encyclopedic, the Commission fell short of a number of goals. Obviously, it did not have all the coverage in the country that it should have. In fact, after the Truth Commission, when a reparations council started to create a register for victims, it discovered that there are far more victims than those that the Commission ever could have estimated. Perhaps with more time, the Commission would have been able to do so and to register more. The Commission focused a lot in areas where we knew there had been conflict, but it was only at the end of the work of the Commission that we discovered that there were areas, such as the jungle areas, for example, where indigenous peoples had suffered terribly, and their sufferings had been undocumented before. And I don't think the Commission had the time or the resources to cover all that. There were populations that had suffered during the conflict whose experiences really were recorded by the Commission only very provisionally. And I can think of the LGBT population. LGBTs had been victimized by guerrilla groups in several areas, and those patterns and those cases of massacres and killings of LGBT people were discovered by the Commission at the end of its work, and so they were never really appropriately documented. We included a few elements in our final report, but there are pending issues for sure. But what I would say is important is that even though there are pending issues, what is significant is to recognize that those issues exist and that those populations do have a right to know the truth. People who suffered because of the conflict, people who suffered in different ways, in different regions, even if the Commission was unable to get there, I think all of them do have a right to the truth, and they should continue claiming for the implementation of the work of the Commission and for further recognition of their experiences.
Well, we'll certainly be looking in more depth in the impact and legacy of the CVR over the next several weeks. We will be reporting live via our Spanish language website from the conference itself, conducting interviews with the likes of the former president of the Commission and other actors in the Peruvian society to explore this in more depth, exactly to establish what the legacy is and present it to our audiences. Now we'll turn to Philippines, where there are ongoing peace talks between the government and the main Islamic rebel group, Moro Islamic Front, which aims to end what is almost 40 years running insurgency. We have seen in the past weeks somewhat of an upsurge in violence where there were clashes between the groups like Abu Sayyaf and the government, which left some military but also rebels dead. Ruben, how do these clashes impact the peace talks, and where do you see them in terms of what is realistic to expect?
The peace talks between the government and the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, it's not the first time that there have been peace talks between the government and various groups of Moro secessionists. There was an earlier peace process that led to an agreement between the government and the Moro National Liberation Front, which was the mother group from which the MILF split. The clashes that you referred to are partly ascribed to some other splinter groups. They're also partly ascribed to the Abu Sayyaf and to other armed groups. And I think this has always been part of the background of peace talks. There are always splinter groups. There are always what other people will often describe as spoilers to the peace process. The good thing, however, is that the ongoing peace talks have built some momentum to a point where the actions of spoilers, the actions of splinter groups, do not seem to have affected the commitment and the willingness of the parties, the government and the MILF, to forge ahead. So far, they've signed what they call a framework agreement. This is not the final peace agreement. The framework agreement then refers to four other sub-agreements, which I think are the technically more difficult agreements to negotiate. So the four include the first on transitional arrangements. What happens when you now have the so-called Bangsa Moro, the Moro nation established? The second technical agreement deals with wealth sharing and resources between the Philippine government and the Moro nation. The third agreement refers to what they call the power sharing arrangements between the government and whatever Moro entity is established. And the fourth agreement is referred to as normalization, but this is where perhaps ICTJ's interest might be, because it is in this normalization agreement where there is a single sentence that refers to transitional justice as a means of addressing the historic injustices against the Moro people, the human rights violations that took place over the 40 years of conflict, and what is also described as legitimate grievances, not just of the Bangsa Moro, but also of about more than 10 indigenous ethnic groups in the same region. So far, it's been difficult, but like I said, they have gained some momentum. I think the most important aspect right now is the willingness of both sides to come to an agreement within the time that they themselves set. They agreed to try to come up with an agreement before 2016. 2016 is crucial because that's the end of the term of the current president, and I think it's important that this agreement be signed under his presidency, because there's a lot of trust in this president, regardless of some of the criticism against him. He comes from a family that is seen as a family of victims of the dictatorship, and so is perceived as being able to understand not just the violations that happened to the Moro people individually, but even the sense of justice that they're asking for. So this is what we should be looking out for, not just the agreements themselves, but the pace by which the agreements are being signed.
What do you think is realistic to expect when it comes to possible transitional justice mechanisms to be established as part of the ultimately, hopefully, the peace deal that is reached?
Well, there are two ways of looking at this. The most positive way and the less positive way. The most positive, of course, is the fact that it is only in this framework agreement so far that there's been a reference to transitional justice in the entire, you know, number of decades that these negotiations have been going on and off. In the previous agreement that was signed with the mother secessionist group, no reference whatsoever was made to transitional justice. They went ahead, established an autonomous government, and that government is seen largely as a failure. And I think part of that failure comes from the fact that there was never any attempt at accountability that would have followed from establishing an autonomous government. Now, so that's very positive that they refer to transitional justice now. The less positive side is that this aspect of transitional justice is seen as an outcome of the negotiation rather than something that either should run parallel to the negotiations, or at least is something that the state itself, the Philippine government, should initiate regardless of the negotiations. In other words, I see a problem where transitional justice is a negotiated outcome rather than something that the state initiates. And there shouldn't be a problem for the state, for the Philippine government, to initiate it, among other things that have happened under the Aquino presidency. A reparations law was passed last year, recognizing victims of the Marcos dictatorship and establishing a reparations program for them. And so that obviously shows that there is an effort to do that. Hopefully, given the attention that transitional justice in the peace process in Mindanao is getting, given as well the support that the international community is giving to the process, there is a third-party monitoring group right now that includes the ambassador of the EU, includes the chair of the Asia Foundation, includes a Turkish representative, human rights NGO from Turkey, and local human rights NGOs, that shows you as well the interest of the international community in the process. So the World Bank has committed, I think, about $7 million in what it calls a fast-track process to support the entire peace process, and hopefully that will include, you know, some funding, some resources, so that transitional justice doesn't end with just one sentence in the framework agreement.
Well, we are sure to follow closely all the developments around this as the peace talks advance. But the issue of accountability, especially in such powerful regional players like Philippines are, is something that we will be talking about while looking at this cultural phenomenon that a newly released documentary called The Act of Killing is. The film looks into the crimes that some people actually refer to as genocide committed in the 1960s after the overthrow of the President Sukarno and the new regime of General Suharto, where people deemed to be communists, but actually all kinds of different groups that were targeted were killed en masse. The film looks into the people who committed the killings, who have been celebrated as heroes throughout the years of Suharto regime, and even today, and in a very disturbing way through reenactments in which the killers themselves take part, sort of reveals the banality but also brings them to the point where they transcend what is an understanding that this was completely normal and completely right for them to do, to the point where they, this veneer of righteousness starts to crack and they start to ask themselves about what they actually did. The film itself is already, as I said, a cultural phenomenon, and a lot has been written about it and said about it, and it's now a front runner for an Oscar in documentary film category. But what I would like to for us to discuss is the impact of this film and the issues that it raises. And I will turn to you, Ruben, because I know that you had discussions with our colleagues from Indonesia on what do you believe are the perceptions around this film. We have to take into account the fact that the impact that it had in the country far surpasses much of what has been done in the past in terms of trying to get this discussion about accountability. More than 600 screenings have been organized so far. A very influential magazine called Tempo dedicated an entire issue to it. There is a thriving black market sort of distribution of the film. And all this is causing a debate about the accountability for what has taken place. What do you think was the impact in Indonesia, and how do people there see the film?
When the past is seen as something that is still an issue in the present, I think it's always a good thing. And that's one of the things that this film has accomplished, not just in Indonesia, and perhaps obviously outside of Indonesia it has accomplished that to an extent. But it would probably be even more important for that to be accomplished in Indonesia in a way that changes the narrative about what happened in 1965, that looks at not only the conduct of individual perpetrators, but the conduct of institutions as well that were involved in 1965. And most importantly, that brings some attention, brings the kind of focus that a camera can give, but this time beyond the camera, to the situation of those who were killed, the families of those who were killed, and to those who survived. ICTJ's work in Indonesia has included a lot of research into the situation of these survivors. I've had meetings with the survivors as they've grown old over the years, and it's always a despairing meeting because in Indonesia itself, not much attention is given to them, both by the state and even by ordinary people who still see the events of 1965 the way Suharto depicted them, that this was meant to exterminate communists who would turn Indonesia into a godless country, and that, you know, people who believed in Islam should act against the communists. And I think this brings attention to the other side of that story, which I think is a way of beginning the process again in Indonesia of perhaps leading to accountability. Now, having said that, for many of those who have worked on transitional justice in Indonesia, this film is, of course, only one step of many that have tried to bring back the discourse on accountability. And I think part of the frustration that some of them might have is in the fact that it takes someone from outside and a film that's popular in the West to call attention to something inside Indonesia, to something that people know but haven't seen from this perspective. But I think overall, there's a very important acceptance that this story isn't just you know, isn't the whole story. It's the beginning of a story, and that there are more stories that ought to come out.
It's interesting, the power of movie making, right? You can think of other movies that have had significant impact to mobilize public opinion. I can think of Missing, the movie by Costa Gavras, denouncing the killings in Chile and the disappearances in that country. Think of Puenzo's The Official History, which made an Oscar in the 80s, denouncing the issue of the disappeared children in Argentina. So this is in that tradition. And what is interesting is also that this is an intervention of memory in the cultural agenda, which is particularly important in a country like Indonesia, because what the regime of Suharto did in that country very consciously was to suppress any kind of memory and any kind of intervention of intellectuals into memory aspects. People who had been what Indonesians call tapos or political prisoners were forbidden to, for example, be teachers, be artists. They were forbidden to be puppet players. And puppet playing is, of course, an important traditional form of theater in Indonesia. So the fact that this is happening in movie making is very, very significant in my view.
I think that it is very interesting to actually consider the method that the filmmaker used. And I'll just in parentheses, do keep in mind, this was actually a postdoctoral thesis that took 9 years to produce, and it actually took this form of a documentary film in the end. But he looked into the lives and the psyche of the perpetrators. And that is not something that ordinarily we tend to do when we examine events like this. Usually it is the victims that we look to give us the narrative of what transpired, while perpetrators, for sometimes very obvious reasons, they don't want to implicate themselves further, tend to stay away. Here it was the other way around. The survivors and the victims were very reluctant to actually come forward and talk about this, and for this reason he turned to perpetrators and found something that the New Yorker magazine actually described as one of the main characters is called Anwar Kongo, and he in the film he actually portrays an image of this very, I would have to say, amusing person who has various different ways of coping with the fact that he himself killed 1,000 people at least, and is not shy at all from actually demonstrating very proudly a method of using a piano wire, of doing it with less blood, as he says. And the New Yorker says, Anwar Kongo's performances, hallucinatory, garish, contradictory, insane even, are projections of his psyche and by extension the psyche of a nation significantly in denial. Does this present, in your opinion, the state of Indonesian society? Is it significantly in denial? When people like Anwar Kongo are still regarded as heroes?
Not only is it in denial, the state of consciousness about what happened in 1965, but it's also a state of supplanting it with a different narrative. And the fact that you have as public officials, some of them the highest public officials in Indonesia, those who were directly or indirectly involved in the Suharto regime still in power, shows you the depth of the way denial has entrenched itself in Indonesia. Having said that, while I do appreciate how this film attempts to look at it from the perspective of what a perpetrator did and how that perpetrator sees his actions, what I hope will happen is that this will also call attention to perhaps narratives about victims, including even locally made Indonesian-produced films that have had difficulty getting distribution and being shown, that are about victims. There's an Indonesian movie, I think, called The Bridge, which was about a massacre on a bridge that was part of the 1965 events, which I think ought to also get some attention, because this is a perspective that is hardly seen.
And we need to remember also that the crimes of 1965 are only one of the waves of massacre and atrocity that took place under the Suharto regime. There were brutal suppressions of nationalistic and ethnic rebellions in places like Aceh, the illegal annexation of East Timor and the presence of Indonesia in East Timor for 24 years, which caused over 100,000 people killed, according to the Truth Commission of that country. Of course, the suppression of nationalistic feelings in West Papua and different other areas. Even at the fall of the regime of Suharto, there were horrendous cases of police abuse, disappearances, and all those cases have left an imprint of impunity. And Golkar, the party of President Suharto, is a powerful institution. General Wiranto, a repressor who participated in East Timor, was a presidential candidate. So it is indeed a society that needs to come to grips with the fact that it has glorified killers, criminals against humanity, people who committed persecution, and tremendous atrocities. So hopefully this will open a very needed debate in Indonesia and will give an opportunity to victims who have been claiming for justice for decades, actually.
And one very resonant point, perhaps, from this Indonesian experience and the renewed attention to the role of Suharto and the role of the generals and the role of the military in Indonesia, is the fact that if you do not address, if you do not confront the role of the military as an institution and as individuals in a dictatorship, then any change, any transition on the civilian side, any elections that happen that purport to elect civilian officials that does not come with accountability for the military will always face this fragility that we now see in places like Egypt.
And I think to further develop this, going beyond Indonesia in the significance of the issues that this film raises, and it raises so many relevant to our field, is this notion best captured in one sentence that one of these killers says very nonchalantly in sort of contemplating how to describe what he did. And he said, war crimes are defined by the winners, and I was a winner and therefore not a war criminal. This basically echoes the same thoughts given in another documentary, Fog of War, by former defense minister of the United States, Robert McNamara, who in reference to firebombing of Tokyo talks about the conversation with General LeMay, who said, look, had we not won this war, we would have been branded as war criminals for what we have done. Many sort of comments that follow this film in terms of its criticism are about looking into these killers as sort of human beings, very complex, not black and white people who at the same time can teach their children how to care for animals and then not feel any remorse about killing thousands. Is this something that we ascribe truly to war criminals who come on the winning side, this complex human dimension, while if they are defeated, if their ideologies are defeated, we rarely venture into trying to portray them as human beings?
Those are two different topics, right? It's interesting your hypothesis conflates those a bit. Well, first of all, clearly the dictum of power is always that power is what makes might, what makes law, that the winner defines the rules and defines the morality. And of course, this is an argument that was raised at the end of World War II by Hermann Göring in the dock in Nuremberg. He clearly said that he was there only because he had lost. And the response is, of course, that he was not there for an act of revenge, but for an act of submission to law, which was impartial. And the entire project of human rights and the entire project of transitional justice is to demonstrate that justice cannot be and should not be linked up to the contingency of who won, which is why in many societies it is so different, so difficult to help the people understand that independently of who won, you have to try perpetrators. In a country like my country, in Peru, when you demonstrate that there were human rights atrocities committed by the army, even if Peru had the authority to defend itself against the Shining Path, many people think that that is some kind of act of treason to the fatherland, that you cannot touch the military because they won a war against an atrocious terrorist organization. So that is a very basic issue that indeed causes enormous confusion into the people. I think that, in fact, common sense aligns very much with power sometimes. Now, interestingly, of course, it happens that those who won are seen as humans and those who lost are seen as non-humans because they were branded as non-humans in order to kill them. You cannot kill people in such a way if you think that they are really people. You have to brutalize them. You have to dehumanize them. You have to brand them in one way that is stigmatizing, right? Those are communists or those are separatists, etc. Those are non-human. And so, by extension, the killer ends up being a human. And that is the incredibly paradoxical thing indeed. But I do think that what we need to do is to see these instruments of culture, like films, like books, narratives, memories. There were so many memories of perpetrators that came out of Rwanda, for example. We need to see them as an invitation to reflect on the common humanity of everyone. And I think when I say humanity, I refer to the fact that everyone is morally responsible. And that implies that perpetrators, yes, they are human, but human in the sense that they are given with moral capacity to judge, to know what is good and what is wrong. And in that sense, I think that is precisely the point we should take. That is the humanization that we should do and that we should accept, seeing everyone as a moral agent with moral responsibility.
Perhaps one unintended consequence of the question you raise about the humanization of perpetrators in this movie, as an example, is that it might raise the question of whether these are the only perpetrators that we ought to be thinking about. Because once you humanize these perpetrators, you wonder why they would do such a thing. And you then begin to ask, who made them do such a thing? And so this escalates questions in a way that I think is useful, not just for memory, for truth-seeking, for the work we do, but also for institutions like the ICC or for attempts at criminal justice. When we define persons most responsible in the Rome Statute, what do we mean? When we say crimes against humanity, who are we referring to as the criminals? And so when we raise these questions, as the movie does raise, perhaps intentionally or unintentionally, I think it always helps in terms of the work we do, in terms of seeking accountability.
I would agree, and I think that the director Joshua Oppenheimer would agree, as he in one interview basically said, we need to understand and learn about how this became possible instead of ascribing these people with some sort of monstrous identity. We need to understand that they were humans, and then we can hope to understand what actually led to them acting the way they did. Well, I have to say that the film raises so very many issues that are relevant to us and the work that we do, and I'm thankful for that. And just as one of the main protagonists, Anwar Kongo, towards the end, from his entrenched position of believing that he did good, starts to actually come to terms with the reality. I hope that this film contributes to a similar process in Indonesia, but also beyond, because I do deeply believe in the power of this cultural output
as you put it, Eduardo, to address these issues and to deeper develop them. And to that end, I think it is very positive that we are nearing the completion of a project which looks into exactly this, the relationship between culture and transitional justice, and the book is to come out in the coming months, and we will be talking about this and presenting it in more detail. But for this episode of ICTJ Forum, I think this will end it, and I thank you, gentlemen, for participation, and to all our listeners, all the best until the next time.